out there. It is I, your not-so-humble host, back at it. Another episode for you guys. Thank you so much for tuning in. I know that it's been a really long time since I have posted a last episode, and I don't have a good excuse. Life comes at you real fast sometimes, and life came at me real fast, and I had to deal with the life stuff, and the podcast had to be put on hold just for a little bit, not too long, because I'm back at it again with more episodes for you guys. I have some incredible guests lined up that I will be putting out over the course of the next few months, and I'm excited about each of them. They're all great, and yeah. We're going to start out with April Wolf, who is one of the writers of the recent Black Christmas movie, and I can't believe that she said yes to come onto this pithy little podcast. I'm honestly shook. But she did, and we had a great conversation. We talked about internet trolls and all kinds of stuff. Cats. We talked about, not the movie, but actual real cats. We talked about a lot of fun stuff, and I'm super excited to be able to share this with you. Alright, so stay tuned. I'll be back at it again in another 2 weeks with a new episode and a new special guest. In the meantime, please keep up with me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, the Yellow Pages, if you still got them, Grindr, Tinder, Bumble, what's that new one? What's the one I just... Hinge. Check me out on Hinge. I'm not on any of that shit, but just stay tuned for another episode. See you guys later. Bye! Hello out there. It is I, your not-so-humble host, back again for another episode. You tried to get rid of me. You tried to burn me at the stake. You tried to stab me in the heart, and yet it didn't work. I'm back again, infecting your eardrums with a new episode, and I have a very, very special guest, April Wolf, who is a podcaster, a writer, an icon, a Twitter visionary. And I'm so honored and happy to have her on the podcast. This is the biggest person of Hollywood stature that I've had on the podcast, and I'm a little nervous, but it's going to be a great episode, and we're going to talk about 1999's Ravenous movie, as well as talking a little bit more about the Black Christmas movie and all that entails. April, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. This is great.
Is that too much? Was I going too hard? Your Twitter is fantastic. I've been following your Twitter for so long. And you're hilarious. You tweet the wildest stuff, and I've been a huge fan of just following you on Twitter. That's it. That's all your other work. Don't care about that.
I know that honestly, a lot of people who I meet, they're like, "Oh yeah, on Twitter," and I'm like, "I like made a movie."
You know, not interested in that whatsoever. The Twitter,
the Twitter, this free app, you know.
You know, it's a different kind of thing. You go, you work on a film, you know, we don't hear about that for months, maybe a year at a time or something like that. But those tweets, that's a shot of a dopamine every single day. Oh, yeah. Oh my God. Thank you so much for coming on. Can you tell a little bit of your background to the listeners?
Oh, my background is very complex. I've never done just one thing. So, I've done pretty much every job you can imagine, but film always a love and a passion of mine. And I didn't come from a family where you were an artist. You were a bartender, a waitress, or sometimes you could go to a course to become an accountant. And that's like it. And so I kind of, in the you know, oddball in my family, and it's taken me a really long time to try to find my path into film and filmmaking, specifically because I didn't have any kind of mentors. I just stumbled my way through everything, and you know, it's I'm like new in my career, but not new in my career. I've just been stumbling around for a very long time.
No, that's awesome. I come from a very similar family, like blue collar, you know, the idea of working full time as an artist is so bizarre, you know, even still to this day, my family is still like, so what is it that you do exactly for a living? And it's a really hard conversation to have. But I mean, for somebody who, the way that you say it, you make it sound so humble. You're talking about Black Christmas, a remake of a movie that so many people know. You're talking about working with Blumhouse, which is an icon, a titan of horror. So yeah. I would say you're doing pretty good. Yeah. I would say you're doing pretty good right now.
Thanks, but honestly, it was all sudden. It's you know, and if there's anyone who wants to do what I'm doing listening, I think it's really good to know that it is true. It can happen very quickly, like those big things, but most of your life is just kind of like doing the work to be prepared for when someone taps you. Yeah. And that's so much of it. It's just like, I'm not totally used to everything that's happened in the past, like year or two, even with like Switchblade Sisters and some other things. It's just, I'm not used to it. I'm just used to like the hustle. That's it, you know?
I mean, but the hustle never stops though, right? I mean, like, even though you got this huge film, you're still out there. I was looking just today to check to see what the newest episodes of your podcast, Switchblade Sisters, was. And I was like, oh, you've still been making podcast episodes throughout everything that's happened. And I was like, if anybody had an excuse to be like, listen, I just made a movie, you know, I'm really busy right now, it was you. But I was like, wow, you're still, I'll stop recording podcast episodes if I have like, if my foot hurts, I'll be like, sorry, you guys, it's not happening today.
I mean, it's okay. So being backed by Maximum Fund for Switchblade Sisters is, first off, I get those resources, but then the trade-off is like, they're like, no, you need to have an episode every single week. And so when you sign up and on for that, you know that you're going to have to put in the work. And I do a lot of work. It probably takes me about a day on average to do research for every episode, which is fucking ridiculous. I don't know why I'm doing it, but it just takes a really long time, and I like making things hard for myself, quite clearly. Eventually I'll probably have to kind of step away or lessen my involvement with it, just because I have some other movie and projects that are happening and they're going to take up my time. But the thing is that I keep coming back to it because I get to talk to so many interesting people about so many interesting movies. And as a filmmaker myself, going through all of these interviews that I do to try to do research on genre films for the podcast, for my guests, it gives me inspiration endlessly. So it's kind of a feeding of your soul public service thing.
Yeah. So what's your background with horror? Like, because it seems like you're, for a really long time, as long as I've been following you, which is probably the past couple of years, your brand is horror, you know?
Yeah.
That you know, you've got this podcast, you're writing. So how did this all start for you? I mean, we can go back to the cradle. Like, what's the origin story?
To the cradle. I mean, I've talked about this before, but my grandparents raised me from a young age until I was like 12. And then I moved in with my mom. And it was, they are horror fans. My grandfather is a huge horror fan and he's a gore hound. So he loves the gorier the better. And my grandmother is more of like psychological thriller, like women, you know, in peril kind of thing. And so every night we would watch like 2 to 3 horror movies, and we would do like, we would stay up all night. We would do like the Sunday, you know, matinee horror. And it's just the thing that I connect with my grandparents on. And so I was raised in that. And I kind of set that aside. I didn't even watch horror for a long time when I was like a teenager through my early 20s. And when I came back to it, I was just like, actually, this is very much my identity. And all the things that I was writing were kind of on the margins of horror. And then I just leaned into it. And I was just like, yeah, this is everything that I've always loved. So, yeah.
I mean, for a while, though, like in the 90s and stuff like that, you know, horror kind of had like a dip, you know. It was this really weird, I taught a class on urban horror. And that whole time period where you couldn't make a horror movie without LL Cool J, which was a weird time period of movies starring B-list rappers and things like that. And
faculty, as you know, yeah. R&B, like, it was an interesting time. For sure.
It was, yeah. And you had things like Tales from the Hood, and Snoop Dogg was releasing these like direct-to-tape VHS horror movies. And I kind of was like, I had this idea that horror was that, and I didn't really like it at that time period. And then as an adult, I came back around to horror as this sort of other exploration of the world, and that you could actually say something substantive with horror, that horror could have a message to it. I really, you know, I feel the same sort of way of, I dipped off of it and then came back to it in God, the past like maybe 10 years. But there was a long period where I was like, horror is, I don't know what's going on with this genre right now. And then honestly, it feels like maybe after Get Out, maybe after Jordan Peele, we just had this like boom with horror movies that had substance to them or had a message to them or were trying to do deeper dives. Do you see that? Do you see that kind of a change, or what brought you back? What attracted you back into horror?
I think, well, you're bringing up a lot of interesting points. There is, there was a lot of stuff happening in the late 90s and, early to mid aughts it was definitely a growing period for horror, and we can look back at it, you know, like in retrospect and see it very clearly. At the time, I didn't really understand why I wasn't connecting with something. Part of that was the widespread use of digital technology and the fact that we were shooting on digital instead of film, which kind of gave a sense that movies were being made quicker and sloppier. And there was also a kind of the domination of the Saw franchise was not really connecting with me. And I, you know, would never disparage anyone from watching those if that's your thing. I think that it was just like, and I say it like post 9/11, I got depressed. Everyone who like was witness of a certain age and witnessing that, like it was kind of depressing. So it felt like we were kind of wallowing in that, and we were doing that in superhero movies too. We were doing it in all movies. It wasn't just horror. It was just kind of this tone. This is my cat. It was kind of this tone of just pity without hope.
Yeah.
And not that I need hope in everything, because you know some of my favorite things end on like a really bad twist where you're like, oh no. But there was just something that didn't really connect with me with the horror that was being made at that time. And specifically, it was kind of dominated by a more masculinist idea and sensibility. And this kind of sense that the only thing that mattered was gore. And it's tough because if you grew up loving, you know, like a Rick Baker, Stan Winston, or anyone who was doing like amazing effects, even Savini, you know, anyone, like you love gore, but how it is employed is just fascinating, and how much it is the focus of a movie. And at that time, it kind of felt like it was the only focus. I feel like if I watch some of those movies again, I might get something more out of them. But I was too in the moment. Like, it was a very raw time. I mean, for a lot of folks who were just kind of losing their shit in those moments.
I never thought about that. I never thought about the connection to 9/11. And God, you're so right. Because it was also the time period where we're getting a lot of the Saw movies and sort of like the gore for gore's sake. Where the reason of why you're going to go see this movie is because of the fact that you want to see how these people can get ripped apart and the creative ways in which these people are going to be ripped apart. And the plot was kind of second to that whole thing. And then it's also the time period of like the French extremist, that whole, all those movies, all Inside, and even movies like Funny People, you know, which is just so nihilist. Everything was so you know, nothing really matters. Horrible things happen to innocent people who don't deserve it. And something horrible, you might just be, God, it is so post 9/11. This sort of idea of like, these people died in this horrific way for no reason, innocent people. And then so much of the horror was like, yeah, you could just be in your house and just people could break in and just torture you to death and that's it. And that's the movie.
It was tough too. Like it wasn't just even post 9/11. It was post Columbine, post 9/11, post the second Iraq War.
Yeah.
And those three things back to back. I think if you were a millennial like I am, it was really hard to get into movies because they were too much a mirror of the nihilism that you're saying. Yeah. It was too intense and it turned me off. Again, if I watched some of those movies in, you know, maybe in the near future, I'd probably get something out of them that I couldn't bear to get when it was in the moment. So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like there was this, I don't know how exactly, but it was this very like masculine viewpoint of the world. It's kind of the same issue that I have with Black Mirror, where I feel like some episodes that I watch of it, there is this sort of point of view that technology is only a tool that can be used to like manipulate people, that it can't also be this tool. And I feel like Black Mirror is it's almost like a post Me Too kind of a thing. Go with me. This might be a spicy hot take that goes absolutely nowhere. But this idea that so many men have been trapped by technology, that so many men have had their sexual assaults captured by technology, have committed acts of violence, and that's been captured by technology. And it's this horrible tool that is like against people, versus my perspective as a Black woman, that technology has helped me immensely. That technology is this protective tool that I can use. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've been out and something dangerous has happened to me, and my first thought is, turn my phone on, you know, or where is my phone right now? Have my phone over the button for my mom's number, you know, just in case something happens. And technology is this, like, it has connected me to communities that I've never had before, resources that I never had before. And it is this very, like, masculine perspective. I cannot put my finger exactly how, but that that violent.
No, I see what you're saying.
Do you see what I'm trying to? I'm getting at, and it feels hopeless. It feels nihilistic in a way that maybe women and people of color, queer people, trans people, are not can't afford to have. You can't have true nihilism as like as a marginalized group, because if you do, then what's it for? What yeah. are we doing this? Does that make any sense? I'm just like,
it does. And I think that kind of it brings to mind the fact that I think one of my favorite episodes of that series is the one that Jodie Foster did about a woman who is attempting to censor her child, meaning that she gives her child a thing where she literally cannot see things that will hurt her. And to me, that felt like something that I was just like, oh, I can see the horror of that kind of technology, because it's an extension of ourselves and our own fears, as opposed to this kind of thing that's put onto us. And I connect with that one in a different way than I connect with all of the other ones.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm just putting that together, but that's a really fascinating of an idea that I'm going to be thinking about for a while.
Well, that's an academic paper for you, you know.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. okay, speaking of, though, nihilism and a feminine perspective, we talked about talking about the movie Ravenous. 1989. This film has a female director, but not initially. So the female director comes on to this film. Actually, I have, where are you? I have the Wikipedia, which is the Encyclopedia of Alexandra. Okay, so
it was literally like 5 days or something before they started shooting. It was insane.
The production of this film is just wild. 1999 Western horror film directed by Antonia Bird, starring Guy Pearce, who is great in this movie, Robert Carlyle, Jeffrey Jones, and David Arquette. I totally forgot David Arquette was in this movie. So really quickly, though, I'm going to read about the production, like what is the background of this film. So the film was shot on location at the Tatra Mountains, Slovakia, and Durango, Mexico. 1 week before production, the original director, please excuse me for pronouncing his name, I'm doing the best I can, Milcho Menchevsky, I think that's right, was said to have submitted new storyboards, which would have required additional 2 weeks of shooting. The production company, Fox 2000, RIP, eventually agreed to an additional week, with complaints that Menchevsky had refused production meetings with the producers. Meanwhile, Menchevsky complained Fox 2000 executive Laura Zinskin micromanaged the production by vetoing his chosen technicians and casting against his wishes. Shooting was delayed on the first day as Menchevsky and the production were still negotiating over the production budget and shooting schedule. As filming commenced, Menchevsky said Zinskin sent him notes on the rushes, quote, every day, complaining about the amount of dirt on the costumes and the number of close-ups. Screenwriter Ted Griffin was at hand for, quote, constant rewrites during the shooting. After 3 weeks of shooting, Zinskin arrived to the set with director Raja Gosnell in tow to dismiss Menchevsky and place Gosnell in as a replacement. 3 weeks of shooting. Just want to reiterate that. While Menchevsky left the production, the cast has been said to have rejected Gosnell. Robert Carlyle then recommended Antonia Bird, his frequent collaborator and business partner, to take over. Following 10 days of negotiations, we're already 3 weeks of shooting, let's do 10 more days of negotiations, Bird arrived in Prague to helm the production. She too would criticize the circumstances under which the filming would take place, describing the allocated studio space as, quote, horrible, and the scheduling of the shoot, quote, manipulative. She also went on to say her predecessor, Menchevsky, should not be blamed for the problematic production. Wild.
And it gets even wilder throughout the entire filming of it. It's like such a, the behind the scenes is so complex, and it's such a strange film to have suddenly been thrust into the hands of a woman.
Yeah.
Because there's only one woman in this movie, and if you pay any attention to Hollywood, they often will only give women directors movies about women, starring women, which is like, it's, that's great and boring. You know, like, I don't understand the gender essentialism of that is frustrating. Yeah. And, you know, even us talking about what is masculine and what is feminine, I mean, we're kind of going off of like an assumed idea of that, but that doesn't mean that one is male or female, but just the kind of approach or how we've typically thought about masculine or feminine.
Yeah. Not the gender, not specifically like the gender of like assigned birth, but this idea of the masculine perspective, the feminine perspective.
Yeah. And this is an extremely violent and strange film that is, it is a wonder. It is something that I'm thinking about constantly. Just even, I just want to devour all interviews with every person who was involved with this. Of course, Antonia Bird should have had a long career, but she tragically passed early. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And that sucks. So there's not really, you know, she should have been one of our auteurs that we revere, you know, and.
Yeah, there's so many, I feel the same way about, there's so many other female filmmakers that I feel like should have had much longer film careers. I feel the same way about like Mary Harron, who directed American Psycho, that she also didn't go on to make more horror movies. There's so many, I heard the statistic where it's like, the majority of filmmakers in large don't get to make a second feature film, but yeah. the vast majority, I think it's like 80% or something insane like that. And so it's already hard enough. And then you go into the kinds of stories that women are allowed to tell. You know, I always look at, it's like Ravenous, it's American Psycho, like any movie where a woman gets to direct men like that, mm-hmm. Especially American Psycho, because it's such a quote masculine film. It feels so, yeah. You know, and this also feels like such a, which is, it's fucked up. Like this idea of like, oh, it's very masculine because of the fact that there is this sort of, it's graphic. I mean, like, is it because these movies are so violent I'll fully admit that I'm just like, yeah, these are films which I can see them giving to a male director, and the fact mm-hmm. that they gave it to a woman shocks me or surprises me.
Yeah, I mean, it surprises me for sure, but of course, you know, Antonia Bird had a man who was like gunning for her, and you need that kind of ally in this world if you're going to step into that. And but the thing is that, like, you know, we're talking about American Psycho and Ravenous now, and I think that something that I love about those two films is that they're actually examinations of men. You know, they're like, they're not accepting of men as who they are. They're questioning men, you know, in the same way that hopefully we question women in films, like what it means to be that and to step into those roles. And, you know, the relationship that you have between Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle in this film, their characters, is one of kind of love and camaraderie. And it is, I mean, obviously spoiler, but the ending, the image that they're ending on with these two characters is one of, you know, a really bittersweet embrace. You know, there's a reason for that. It's like a romantic scene in a sense between these two men who are in competition with one another, but ultimately Robert Carlyle's character just wants a friend. He wants a buddy.
I totally see this kind of idea of like the examination of masculinity, you know, recently. Have you seen The Lighthouse?
Yeah.
The Lighthouse reminds me a lot of Ravenous.
I absolutely thought of that while we were watching it. It's just like, this is so strange. I don't know what's going to happen moment to moment. Like these two guys caught within the, like in this American wilderness, essentially, you know?
Yes. Yeah, it's two, you know, where you have like, okay, the elements are the elements of horror is both internal and external, you know, and, in a lot of horror movies nowadays, I feel like we're focusing a lot on the internal horror, but to have the horror be like the surroundings in which you're in and the madness of the surroundings, but then also this kind of internal, what are other people capable of doing? And there's this like hate love relationship that is driving the internal horror. And there's like a scene in The Lighthouse. This doesn't ruin anything because The Lighthouse is a wild movie that you just have to see for yourself. But there's a scene where the two main characters are fighting and then they just embrace each other in this very intimate moment that at first so I saw it twice. I first saw it, I thought it was played for laughs. Like I thought it was supposed to be like this kind of like, here's two men and they almost kiss. Cause there's a lot of like odd humor throughout The Lighthouse.
Yeah.
It's funny and you're just like laughing to keep from crying. And I thought, oh, this is kind of like a joke. And then I saw it the second time and I thought, oh, these two dudes are just lonely. They're just two lonely, sad men who are looking for any kind of intimacy. And it feels similarly in Ravenous, where it's like, the question is, what is the emotional, emotionally, go with me now, how are these men being emotionally fed as well as being physically fed? Oh my God. Okay. I'm like going into like another thing. Ravenous could have a double meaning. It could be about food, but it could also be about emotional feeding. Yes. Oh my God.
Yes. And it's also about the feeding of this, you know, we should say that those two movies are particularly American.
Yes.
And American Psycho, despite the fact that it's Canadian, is very American because it is lampooning America. But these are really American ideas of horror and what we're afraid of and what we lack and the hunger that we have, which is essentially in Ravenous, for instance, it's the hunger for a manifest destiny, for something that's war, and continually like consuming more, taking things over, saying that they're ours. And, you know, that's a huge part of the movie Ravenous, is that they are this outpost in the West and they're about to just like take over California. They're, you know, like they are the spot that like the hub for the manifest destiny, you know?
Right.
And I find that really interesting. One of the things that Antonia Bird did when she was making that movie too was that she specifically made sure that the characters had more than just an American accent, you know, that they had foreign accents, because she wanted to, as a woman from the UK, she wanted to make sure that people understood in Europe and America that it wasn't just like this kind of nebulous American that existed. It was Europeans who were coming over and doing this, and they have as much guilt and blame as anyone who is American for taking over this land and for just eating everything.
I think, you know, it is such an American idea of like you have to keep going even though you're putting your life at risk, you know?
I don't know, like, we have so many buffets in America. So many buffets.
You know, like, even if you're past the point of where you're like, I'm gonna vomit, you know, you're still like, when they bring out the new tray of some food, you're like, all right, I'll have a little bit of that. Oh, some more mashed potatoes. I'll have a little bit more of that.
My family has this joke. They're in Michigan, so very Midwestern aesthetic. But they have this joke that on our family crest, it just says, I could eat. That's what they were like, everyone's asking, are you hungry? And everyone's just like, oh, I could eat.
Yeah. I was just having that conversation with my friend. So my friend says it all the time. And I'm like, what does that mean? You could eat.
Exactly. But you know, what does that mean? Like, cause that, to me, that seems like an American invention too. Just like eating is kind of like, it's a communal thing. It's what we do together, but it's also like something that we do out of boredom. And it's something that we feel compelled to do where it's just like, and you know, we're not just talking about like even food. It's just like, well, yeah, I guess I could do something. I guess I could take this.
Right.
I'll take it now.
I mean, we are the country that invented the food competitions where you just stuff yourself under a certain amount of time, you know, which is a very American thing to watch.
Because the Japanese just destroy us now.
Which is like a deeper metaphor. It's a deeper. I mean, I think that, you know, especially like ravenous, this sort of wilderness aspect of a manifest destiny of sort of overcoming and beating the wilderness, of making the wilderness submit to you. And this idea that nature should be at the whims of these men and not the other way around. You know, I think that this sort of natural, this viewpoint that nature is something to be respected, especially in a lot of Western horror, Western horror, there is this sort of like, which I really don't like, but there's this aspect that like, there's like white men on one side and then like the natives on the other side. One side is the side of like getting nature to bend to your will. And then the other side is this idea that nature should be respected in its own, in its own way. Like we should have the room for nature to do what it does, which is nature is ambivalent. Nature doesn't care about, you know, whether or not you really want this or not. Nature does what nature does. And that's the sort of hubris. The fall of these people is not having respect for nature at large. And a lot of horror movies that take place in the West, it falls back on this trope of even a movie I just saw called The Nightingale by Jennifer Kent. Have you seen this movie?
Yeah.
It's brutal. It's a brutal film. I don't know if I would really recommend it to a lot of people.
Because there's like certain people who I'm just like, oh, you will get this. Like there are people like, if there's someone like me who like, I tend to like kind of brutal things, you know, like if they're honest, so I will recommend it to some people, but I wouldn't to everyone, you know.
There's some people I'm like, okay, I think you can handle this, and I think, you know, it's fine, but other people I'm just like, yeah, no. You know, that movie, which is one of the most honest portrayals I've ever seen of that manifest destiny mindset, that kind of we want to dominate over the environment, because so much of it is like, so you have these two characters, one is Aborigine and the other one is Irish? Yes.
Yeah.
And they're going through the outback. And one of the things that I really like about that film is that the race dynamic is still there throughout the entire film. And a lot of movies, you know, they'll do like these things where two people will be out stranded in the wilderness and it'll be a native person and a white person and they become buddies. And, you know, they're like, I see you as a man, not as a native, but as a man. And there's like this whole, you know, this whole equality thing. And in The Nightingale, throughout the entire film, this woman is still like, no, I am white. Like, let's not forget. You know,
I'm still racist. Yeah, she's not just gonna change.
Yeah, she doesn't care. This man is saving her life, and she's still like, "All right," but at the end of the day, you eat on the floor. You know, and it's that's fascinating to me that Jennifer included that in, because it's such an indictment of whiteness, and it that she doesn't sort of forget that. It's such a subtle but accurate portrayal. of the complicitness of whiteness, that you could have this character that you identify with, but at the same time, she doesn't change her viewpoint, her mindset, who she is. She's still the same person. God, that movie ripped me up. I'm sorry. Yeah. That movie was well, so
you know, and that's the thing also, is that she actually had Aboriginal consultants that were paid like on staff to kind of keep her honest in this story. And I can't imagine that an Aboriginal consultant would be like leaning towards a happy ending for these two people, because it's like they know like very intimately that people will look at their, like, cling to their whiteness over any other solidarity. Like they're pretty in the know about that.
Yeah, and that's why, like, I consider that to be, like, not just Western horror, but also, like, this wilderness horror. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, like, what is horror, you know? Even on the Ravenous Wikipedia page, people, there was a thing about that some people consider this film to be, like, a black comedy, or like a commentary on something more so than just like a thriller, more so than it being a quote unquote horror film, which, like, to me, those conversations are boring about what is horror, because it's like, who makes that decision? Who decides?
You know, I think that's why, like, for, you know, my podcast, I say that it's all genres, because I feel like there's too many intersections of genre filmmaking to kind of classify them as one or the other, because they're going to have elements of some, and there's certain things that we would typically think are horror cinematography, right? And we have this idea of what we think horror cinematography is. So if you don't have that same cinematography, then you are not seen as horror, because you're not trying to evoke scares in the same way that that people are used to, because of something that they grew up on. But I'm probably like you in that I see it very differently.
I mean, I consider, like, one of the most terrifying movies that I really don't want to watch anymore, that I saw one time, is 12 Years a Slave. Like, 12 Years a Slave to me is like the most horrific movie I've ever seen, because I know that it has such a basis in reality and actual history. And that movie is like a movie, whenever anybody says, what's the scariest movie you've ever seen? And I'm always like, well, it's 12 Years a Slave. Like, that, you know, that's what qualifies to me. And I have no interest in sort of like the gatekeeping that happens in horror, is like, I guess we can segue right into Black Christmas, because it's a huge issue.
That's a good time. Yeah.
A huge issue. This, okay. If I can be very, very honest with you, there was, in the horror community, this rise of gatekeeperism that happened with your film, that meant that nearly almost every single day, I was on Twitter fighting some unwashed, ashy, dry man about this movie. Some man I know who just has the driest hands. It's just, I just know this man is not moisturized, about this film. And it drove me out of my head, like, to where there was one day where I was like, I think I'm gonna have to put this movie on my muted list, because I just don't want to hear another random person's viewpoint about this movie. And I've been doing this, honestly, I feel like since the Ghostbusters movie came out a couple of years ago, where my whole day is just filled with talking to some dry, crusty-eyed man about this movie. And I mean, how do you feel about this? How are you feeling?
love trouble. So I've always been someone who is fine with some controversy, as long as I feel like I am secure and I'm not being an asshole. As long as I'm the one who's leading with kindness or with intelligence or with openness, then I feel good about whatever my part is in it. And in this case, I think that it was really testing me. But I think ultimately, despite all this negative stuff, I do think that there was a reckoning that needed to happen. Yeah. And I think I feel worse for Sophia Tikal, who directed Black Christmas, because she is less experienced with that kind of flash of controversy, and she doesn't kind of court it or invite it in the way that I do. Just from what my positions have been in writing. So I feel bad for her, but in terms of what the conversation is and how it needed to happen, I think that this is potentially the only way. And it is something that makes me maybe even prouder of what we were able to accomplish with Black Christmas, because there were so many obstacles and so many challenges set out that most men never have to do to even make a movie. And we rose to every challenge that was given to us. And, we made a movie in 8 months, and it was in theaters, wide release. And that is insane. That doesn't happen. But that was the only way that we were going to be able to get a movie in as women writers and a director, was to take that challenge and just go with it. And then to kind of run with what our guts said. And our guts said that we were pissed about the patriarchy. And that if we weren't honest and if we didn't make a movie that kept us honest in how we felt right now, then we would regret it. And it's a movie that I think people will be able to revisit years from now and understand at least a little bit of how women felt. There is also the idea, I mean, we made a lot of the subtext that you see in horror films into text with regard to women specifically, because people tend to only like feminism when it's in subtext, because then they can interpret it however they want. But when we say explicitly this is what feminism is or could be, they get mad. Now, that's not to say that there isn't any subtext. I think a lot of people were missing the fact that there is subtext in terms of intersectionality, which is something that is about, you know, race and class and gender essentialism. And there are things that I think some people in the melee may have missed, that maybe us even critiquing the women that we are holding up, that there is a critique. They are from a certain wealth background. They have a certain privilege. And there's something to be said about that stuff. I am surprised that there wasn't anyone who was writing about or talking about those particular things. And I know I'm going on for a long time. There's also the idea of Camille Paglia playing a large role, who is a quote-unquote feminist theorist, who says that she is trans, but only to get a rise out of the trans community. Mm. And we have these kind of, like male versus female binaries in this movie. And there's also a kind of rallying against that in the subtext to me, that that it is not just a two-gender thing with the genders consistently in battle. Like, it is something larger than that. But anyway, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, we're very proud of.
You should be very proud of it, you know. And I think it's so unfair that this happens, actually, I feel like, with a lot of these movies. A lot of movies where they're made with women, and there's this controversy, quote unquote, that pops up around it, is that we're so busy talking about the controversy that we can't even have a conversation about what this film is.
And how it was made.
Right. And it's so frustrating, because then then, you know, it gets picked up by online and stuff like that. And then that becomes the conversation that we're just talking about what people are talking about instead of actually mm-hmm. talking about the movie. So I wanted to ask, how did you come into this film? Was it, did you pitch it or was it something that was already started?
Despite what Abra says, yeah. It wasn't a movie that I had, it wasn't a movie that I had pitched to do a rewrite of, you know, it wasn't that. They already knew that they wanted to do a Black Christmas remake. They hired Sophia, and they knew that they wanted to have it come out Friday, December 13th of 2019. And at that point in time, they needed someone who was just like really solely focused on writing because Sophia was going to have to be doing things too. And so that's why they brought me on. So I came on April 1st. I had pitched Sophia a few ideas because she was kind of getting stuck. And I was just like, well, what if this? What if this? And she latched onto a few of them. And we just went from there. And it was very quick. There was no time to think. And Cooper Samuelson, who was our exec at Blumhouse, he's a producer with us. He, you know, after the movie had come out, he really loved it because it was so different from anything that Blumhouse had ever done or that he had ever done. Mm-hmm. And, but he had also said that the process of making it was something that you can see on the screen because it's a movie about that is feeling first and thinking second, because it's just like, there's no time to kind of second guess those things. It's just like, I'm feeling this, so I'm doing this. I'm feeling this, so I'm doing this. So it's all out there, like we just kind of vomit it on the page, you know?
And I feel like, you know, one of the other things that I think is really interesting about this film, I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't seen it already, but one of the other things is that it just came out after the whole thing with Jason Blum being sort of called out on not having that much female representation in Blumhouse, and that also was part of the conversation as well. I think that maybe that fed into this sort of like higher scrutiny of the film, that people were like, I don't know, that people were saying like, oh, did you just get it because of the fact that he had been called out, even though those conversations were already happening by the time that all of it, you know, like, so people's perception of it, they just kind of made that the narrative of this film, placed that on top of the film when it first happened. And then the idea that this is a movie made by women and the bad guys are white dudes, you know, or that they're dudes, you know, and the movie is somehow hates on men. I mean, like, what's the controversy that dudes are the enemy? Like, have you seen Night of the Creeps? Like, it's not like a new concept. There was something else that was going on top of this that contributed to this controversy. I'm not the biggest fan of the original Black Christmas, you know, the same way that some other people are. Mm-hmm. The original Black Christmas, I felt like it had the opposite, the feeling, it had a lot of like coldness to it. I think that has to do with the fact that the original takes the perspective of the killer throughout the entire film.
Yeah, it's like a giallo perspective, the kind of like black gloved kind of POV camera. Yeah.
And I don't want that. Like I personally
No.
I'm good. Thank you. I for me, I'm just like, oh no, I wouldn't be, if I was in this film, I would not be on that side. I would not be on the side looking through the eyes of the killer. I don't want to look through the eyes of the killer. My first emotional instinct is to be on the side of these women. So taking and viewing that and kind of flipping that around alienated me as an audience member. And it just, for me, that device of the giallo through the eyes, that we never get a good look at the killer, he's always in shadow and stuff like that, reminds me that this is not my movie. That's not a movie that's made with me in mind, and it's not made for me. And Black Christmas, the new version of it, is sort of the flip of that, in that this movie is saying to the female audience, this is your movie. This is a movie for you. We see you. We're representing you. And there's a group of people who have never been told this movie is not for you. Maybe this movie is not through your lens. And their first reaction to that was to be a bunch of bastards about it. I can only imagine how frustrating that. If it's frustrating to you at all.
It's frustrating a little bit. One of the things that I was really analyzing, because like as a critic and on the other side of it and a filmmaker, I'm fascinated by reactions and why people do the things that they do. One of the things that I was thinking about was the fact that Sophia and I explicitly made our women not traditionally sexy. Mm-hmm. The so-called lead, I think that there's two leads. I think Imogen Poots and Elise Shannon, who plays Chris, to me that they were like two sides of the same coin. They were kind of co-leads, but we were like teasing that they weren't. Those characters, the only time that they're presented as sexy is when they're calling out rape culture. So it's a kind of like, we trick you into being like, oh, they're so sexy, they're going to do a Mean Girls thing. But instead, that's not what you get. You get them being extremely abrasive. And we turned that again and again and again. Like in the final scene, there's like, most women are wearing sweats. They're wearing fucking sweatsuits, dude. Like they're comfy, they're at home. And it's like, it's something that I think that it's hitting a subconscious part of a lot of people's brains. And that's both men and women, because I don't think that people are used to this. And that's what I'm saying about Black Christmas. Like, I'm not going to say that the movie is flawless, but I'm saying that we did a lot of things that people aren't going to know are as strange as they are for horror films until you look back on it. But like, you know, we're subverting some Final Girl tropes in that. And I had so many men in my mentions who were so, so angry that we didn't have a traditional Final Girl. And they were telling me how the Final Girl was feminist and how we needed to abide by it. And it was just like, the Final Girl has always been problematic, and we've always talked about it. Like, feminists have always both embraced and shunned it, and we've found a way to kind of think through it. And so once women are finally behind the camera and we're like, well, maybe we're gonna do something different, then all of a sudden it's just like, it's feminist canon. And you're like, what? And if you look at the kind of idea of sexiness and horror, and I'm not going to say that like sex and horror shouldn't go together, because I think that some of my favorite films have this, like, they're kind of like dripping with sexuality. And in fact, one that I'm working on for the near future is very much combining sexuality and horror. And this one particularly, though, we kept that away, because when you're talking about a story with date rape, the last thing that you want to do is sexualize things. So it's just like, it felt really important for us to keep those separate, in a sense. And the thing is, like, if you look at the reception of something like Carey Mulligan's new movie that's coming out, the Killing Eve writer.
I just saw the poster for that the other day, and it's like, oh, it's a wild name. Promising Young Woman.
Yeah. So yes. If you look at the reception for Carey Mulligan's new movie, Promising Young Woman, and you know, the premise of that movie is actually not far off from ours, and is actually more sadistic, right? Because it's like a young woman who is raped in college, and she then kind of goes and tempts other men to see if they're going to take the bait to try to rape another woman, and then she punishes them, right? Now, this is, I would say, more explicitly and kind of like anti-man in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way, right? We know what she's doing. But the thing is that it's an extremely sexy movie. The trailer is sexy. Carey Mulligan is sexy. There's a they use the Britney Spears song in the trailer, and it's just like, it is bleeding sexuality. And so I would see, for instance, the same people who would tell us that our trailer and then our movie was a piece of shit and it hated men, go and comment on the trailer and the poster for Promising Young Woman and say, "Step on my neck, Carrie." And it's like, it's a weird kind of like thing that I think that some male horror fans have, is that they almost crave a sexiness as they're being tortured, yeah, you know, like that kind of thing. But when you're not sexy and you're like Elise Shannon showing up with like a bow and arrow and just being like, "Fuck off, suck my..." Like, they're like, "No, we hate that."
that's so wild. I think also, like, there was this sort of like understanding, maybe, or that they felt like they were like tricked, that they were going to come in to see Black Christmas and it was going to be that same kind of sexually exploitative kind of greasy kind of a movie, where you do get the sort of salaciousness of killing these women who are all like scantily clad co-eds, you know, and the movie subverts that. Whereas for Promising Young Women, it's like the movie is telling you right up front, like, a bunch of dudes are gonna die in this movie. And that sort of, I mean, the final girl thing is tough for me, because as much as I do recognize it for being this feminist thing, very rarely do we have final girls that are written and produced by women. It's this sort of...
Deborah Hill did like the best one, you know, like, yeah. Deborah Hill doing Laurie Strode is just like,
okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, and also the fact that so many of the final girls are white women, you know, and the idea that I've never seen a final girl who was like me. And so the idea of being in a horror movie, I mean, like, you've heard like the joke, you know, is that I'm going to be the first one to die. And, or, you know, being the kind of sassy Black friend, that's like, "Oh, hell no." And like leaves, you know? And so it's just, it's never really done me any favors. And so revisiting the final girl to say, also to suggest that feminism is stagnant, as though it's just this one thing and it remains this one thing forever. You know, feminism is a theory, and that's, that theory gets revisited over and over and over again. And if you're a feminist, you keep revisiting it as culture changes, as society changes. My mother's feminism is not my feminism, and my feminism has changed dramatically over the course of my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And so those conversations were so frustrating to watch you and your engagement of it. It was, I mean, how you did not just tell every single person to get fucked, I have no idea. Like, you were actually engaging with people and having thoughtful conversations some of the time. And it was just, I think I would have lost my mind. Some of those comments that you were getting were so asinine and stupid. I don't know how you did it, quite frankly. I really commend you for that.
Thanks. I think you kind of have to see those people for how silly they are. They're just, they're very silly and they're very sad and they need some kind of voice. And I see it, and sometimes as like a game where like perhaps all I could do is just like pick one or two a day to engage with, and then like all of a sudden, you know, they would die for me. Step on my neck, April, you know, like.
That should be your new line of shirts, some new stickers. I don't know. I mean, I think it's really incredible that this movie got made. It came at such a good time. You know, we're in this kind of post Me Too time period, and it made so much sense to me to have this movie, especially because it feels like it's in commentary with the first movie. It feels like it's in conversation.
Yeah, we're very much looking at what Bob Clark did, how we would do it differently, you know. And you as a horror scholar, you know that like the first Black Christmas is one of the first proto slashers, right? I mean, if we're not really talking about Psycho, like we're talking about, you know, like the North American kind of classic slasher genre that arose out of the 70s and 80s. So if it's a proto slasher and a lot of people are like, no, it's like the first, and we're looking at that and we're like, well, here's kind of like a final girl that lives in this movie. What if we had a revisionist history? What if women were the first ones to make a slasher? How does the genre look different now? You know, so to us, it was like, it was recreating history in that sense.
I mean, that's not really that far-fetched, because I think there's going to be a group of young women who this is their first slasher. Yeah. You know, I mean, and to think about that, like the next generation of horror movie fans who, just some girl at like 13, 14, this will be the first idea of what a slasher movie is for her. And to go back and revisit Black Christmas, the original, that's a fascinating kind of idea. And I think also the way that people hold up Black Christmas is that it's the rule book for slashers, mm-hmm. That it made the guidelines for how other slashers are to be. And if you try to revisit this tome, this Bible of slasher, that you're somehow, I don't know, perverting the genre or something like that.
Let's pervert that shit. I'm so perverse.
You know, I mean, it's like, it's not like it lives in amber, you know, it's this thing that can be revisited. I think pervert the genre is also your new line of shirts. So.
Pervert the genre. Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, why not? You know, and God, that's so okay. So you're still in horror. You're still doing more horror stuff. Are you hoping to continue doing that?
Yeah, I am doing some horror stuff, but I also have some sci-fi and action projects too. So I will be working within genre, but horror will always be my love. So.
That's awesome. Did you want to do screenwriting? Was that always the goal?
It was always the goal. I got into film criticism and writing about film just because I appreciated film, and I literally had no idea how one became a screenwriter. I was just writing by myself for forever, and the only way that I was able to find a community was by doing film criticism from the other side. So I've been a screenwriter writing, producing films like shorts and features and plays too, a lot of plays, for a very long time. So yeah.
And did this, were you in conversation with Blumhouse before? Like, did you want to work with them this whole entire time? Or were they just like the right people at the right time? I mean, because working with Blumhouse is so, it's so huge. I mean.
Yeah, it's really huge. But the thing is that like, when you're a writer, like I am working with Blumhouse, they're kind of hands off with you, because they're more into kind of guiding the direction, you know, because they have like a pretty like firm kind of visual aesthetic and idea of things. And so I got like a lot of freedom to,
oh, cool.
to do stuff. And I will work with anyone who gives me at least a little bit of slack on the rope, you know?
Yeah. This has been such a good conversation. I know that we've gone over time. I really appreciate you talking about your film and about Ravenous and about Manifest Destiny and stepping on necks. I feel like we've covered so much, and I feel like there's just so much, especially with, you know, this new, I really do feel like we're in this new era in horror.
It's true.
You know, I think that we're having conversations with the genre, and we're sort of revisiting old tropes and having conversations, not necessarily abandoning them. I think, you know, there's this sort of accusation that, you know, the SJWs are going to come in and they're going to make the genre, you know, milquetoast and tame, and, you know, where we're all just going to be using they, them pronouns. And, you know, like, that's the scariest thing that these people can think of.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's their horror movie. They should be loving this shit then.
You know, it's there's a movie I know out there being written by somebody where somebody gets tortured unless they use they, them pronouns. I just know it. I just feel it.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, I think it's exciting. I'm super excited for the new filmmakers that are coming up, and there's been so many more women now who are getting their films greenlit. Whereas I feel like before it was kind of tough. There just seems to be so many more voices that are happening. A friend, Gigi Sal Guerrera, she's getting her films made. She's making out of Canada, right? Films
yeah,
for
Vancouver.
Out of Vancouver, for so long, and it just seems like it's just every other month I'm hearing about another female film director who's getting their horror films greenlit, and I think it's a kick-ass exciting time.
Yeah, I think what we all need to do though is show up for Nia DaCosta when her Candyman comes out, because
I don't know.
You hope that the reception is great, but she is a woman and she's a Black woman, and so it's just like there will be some backlash, but also she's protected in some ways because she's with Jordan Peele and Monkey Paw. But coming out supporting that, I think, is extremely important, because it's you know, you hit those milestone ones and you need to support the milestone ones, and there is trickle down for everyone after. So
yeah, I just saw the poster for it yesterday, I think, and the poster is so gnarly. I think you're absolutely right about that, because, you know, even there was this news that came out that Tony Todd hadn't been casted in the new film, and that, I mean, the way that people were ready to pounce on her, to rip her apart for this rumor that Tony Todd had not been, you know, involved in that, even though it's like nobody had seen the film, nobody knew exactly if there were talks, negotiations, anything like that, if it was a scheduling thing, you know, and the way that people ripped her apart for that, it really was like, oh, like, we've got to protect this person. You know, it's really frustrating, because it's like, for me, watching that stuff, I was like, first of all, I've never heard you guys talk about Candyman before, and suddenly it's this film that you would die for, and which pisses me off, you know?
That Christmas, man, where it's just like, oh, where were you guys when I was watching this before? Like, I thought, okay, all right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, suddenly it's like, you know, my firstborn child, first name Black, last name Christmas, you know, like, I like, lost my virginity to watching this film, you know? It's like,
it meant everything to me. It shaped my childhood. And you're like, okay, well, all right.
You know, and it's That's the cool. same way for Candyman. It's just like suddenly all these people jumped out of the woodwork and they're just like, my grandfather was named Candyman. Like, you know, it's just, it's all this stuff where it's just like, this gatekeeperism that happens in this community is absurd sometimes, to the point where you just have to laugh at it. And God, I'm so excited for this. I mean, Candyman, growing up in a Black community, we didn't have Bloody Mary. We literally did Candyman. Like, that was our urban lore. You know, we didn't have Chucky or Jason or Freddy. We just had Tony Todd in that hideous coat, you know. That's all we had, and so it means so much to me, and to see it being done by this Black filmmaker that is, her other work is so good. I knew it was going to be in the right hands, and together with Jordan Peele, Yahya Abdul, who is one of the main actors in it. I mean, it looks so good, and I'm so scared.
Wait, is it Yahya Abdul-Mateen from...
Yeah. From Watchmen?
Watchmen? Yeah.
Yeah,
he's in it? What?
I'm pretty sure. Let me check on IMDb for somebody.
I don't pay attention to the early stuff, because I would just want to be surprised in the theater, so it's just like, you're kind of spoiling it for me.
I'm so sorry. I am right, but just ignore that. Just ignore me. but it's, you know, it's so sad that, like, when you hear about a movie coming out and it's got a female director, the first thing I'm concerned about is, like, her psychological well-being, you know, that I'm like, is she going to be okay with the assholes? Yeah.
No, it makes me want to reach out to her before the movie comes out and just send her, like a little care package. Jen Yamato did that for me, the film critic and writer over at LA Times. And that was just like, oh, a little like face masks and,
yes!
like nice lotions and stuff. And
oh my God, that's such a good idea. I mean, like that's, I think, you know, as other, you belong into this club that's so small, you know, female horror filmmakers, there's only so many of you guys. And so, you know, I think that that's such a great idea. If you guys ever have a female horror filmmakers retreat, listen, you have my email, you know, I'll serve refreshments. It's, I mean, what a great idea. And that, I really am very inspired by you because, you know, I saw you podcasting, talking about horror, and to see that you are making films now. I also aspire to be a filmmaker. And so, you know, seeing the way that you traverse that, I also am, you know, kind of going down the same route. And I just find you inspirational, and I find your trajectory, I'm a huge fan. I cannot wait for future projects. I stan, we stan, we have no choice but to stan.
Then I'm gonna let you down. I'm gonna be like, oh no, I let her down.
We stan. Once we start standing, we cannot cease standing. Okay.
Okay. All right. This train is taken off. Okay.
And so, you know, but I think that it's great. And, you know, like I said before, it's like the odds are so against women, you know, like the odds are so hard to even get a single film made. And so even that being done is like, well, you know, there's no letting me down because you did it, you know, you did something like, I mean, really, like so many people, you think about how many people want to make films, you know, versus how many people do. It's so, so hard.
I mean, I guess, if anything, I hope that my trajectory shows people that it is possible and that there is no one way to get to where you're going.
Yeah, totally. April, thank you so much for being on the podcast and talking with me and allowing me to chew your ear off about horror movies.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking. This was great.
Thank you. Could you let people know where you are so they can follow this fantastic Twitter account?
They're going to be so disappointed. There's like so much Murder, She Wrote content. It's...
But also, we stan Murder, She Wrote. Murder, She Wrote is so underrated. It's so underrated. That's a whole other.
Oh, everyone's like stanning Columbo, and like, don't get me wrong, I love a Columbo, but Murder, She Wrote.
So they're so horny.
Yes. Yes. sorry, I'm not coming back from that. You can find me on Twitter. Just look me up. There's like a bunch of April Wolfs, but I'm a wolfful, like a handful, but a wolfful.
And are you allowed to talk about what your next projects are? Are you still like?
I'm not allowed yet, but soon I can, hopefully in the next month.
Great.
So, yeah.
Great. That's right around, I think, when this podcast episode will go up in a couple of weeks. And so hopefully that'll come out around the same time. Appreciate you so much. I appreciate you also, the listener. Thank you so much for being a part of this episode. I'm going to climb back into the grave just pour some dirt over top of me, just pat it down real nice, put some flowers over me, and come by, sit by the grave. Maybe you'll hear the midnight howls of me talking about how horny people are and Murder, She Wrote. You never know. Thank you guys so much for listening. Have a great time, and I'll see you again with another episode in 2 more weeks. Bye!